The Truth News Network. Today's noise giving you heartburn? D-A-N. That's how you spell relief. TNN.
The Truth News Network.
Here's Dan Newman.
I really appreciate the compliment from Pete Moss, but I think in this case, we should spell relief T-U-M-S. Everybody that watches the impeachment trial needs some antacid relief, and Tums can do the job. Well, it's Thursday in Impeachmentville. Day 3, Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump is in the record books, and what a day. There are a plethora of things to mention about the activities that occurred in the Senate chamber on day 3, but sadly, none of those things we will say today have anything to do with any evidence of President Trump's wrongdoing or his alleged wrongdoing that supposedly are responsible for bringing us to this place. House Management Leader Representative Adam Schiff took center stage most of the day. He's done that for the first 2 days of the trial. He consumed almost all of the time allotted for House Democrats to present their case to the senators who are going to vote later on the removal of President Trump from office. But they also danced the dance of politics before the television cameras that beamed their impeachment charade to every American who thinks enough about the impeachment trial to take time from their busy lives to take a look. Well, Thursday's Democrat presentation bordered on a story wrapped in desperation. No one knows better than the House managers that their lack of evidence puts them in a spot of almost inevitable failure in their impeachment attempts. To their credit, though, they attempted to stay on point, except, of course, I don't even have to tell you this, Adam Schiff. He wandered all around the world. He speculated that, among other things, we must take care of Ukraine, he said, so they will continue to help us defeat the Russians over there so that we will never need to defeat the Russians over here. I've never thought about the Russians possibly invading the United States. Maybe he knows something that we don't. Several times, their desperation became really obvious. They were so obvious because they actually went back to the Mueller report, where they cherry-picked a few points that, although they were part of Mr. Mueller's exoneration of President Trump for allegedly colluding with the Russians in 2016, Adam Schiff felt there was still enough damning information in the report to fuel this impeachment. Points from the Mueller report rang on mostly deaf ears in the Senate. I probably don't need to tell you that. In fact, a lot of the senators just simply lost interest today. At one point, we counted 14 senators that weren't on the floor and 13 Democrats that weren't on the floor. So why don't we go ahead and do this? Let's look at the day 3 bullet points, and then I'm going to share a very significant letter with you. You don't want to miss that. Bullet points for day 3 of the impeachment trial begin with this. House managers recalled the testimony in the House Judiciary Committee hearing of Harvard law professor Noah Feldman. You may remember that in that hearing, Feldman, as did others, gave a passionate list of justifications for the impeachment of President Trump, none of which were based on any factual information, evidence, or data. Each was exhaustive, too. More importantly, each was strictly opinion, his especially. Schiff, as usual, drew on those Feldman justifications, even though they were entirely unfactual and only opinion. Bullet point 2, many wondered if there would be any pushback from House managers' aggressive and often angry Senate presentations. The first sign of a backlash among that critical group came Thursday when Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, who was a moderate member of the conference and a very important one for them to try to get on their side, she said she was offended by House Manager Representative Gerald Nadler's assertion that GOP members in the Senate who voted against allowing new testimony and evidence were engaged in a cover-up. "I took it as offensive," she told reporters. "As one who was listening attentively," she said, "and working hard to get to a fair process, I was offended." And then, content at the trial on Thursday became so benign that House Manager Hakeem Jeffries at one point just told a story of an American who approached him on the street who was upset about something that Jeffries thought he wanted Democrats to investigate regarding the Trump trial. Instead, the man said this, "Someone voted against Derek Jeter on his Hall of Fame ballot." Former New York Yankees great Derek Jeter was one of three baseball greats inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame recently. Jeter's election was just one vote short of being unanimous. That had a lot to do with impeachment, didn't it? But Jeffries bringing that up on the floor in his presentation of the House manager's case against the president that supports his impeachment, he segued into Derek Jeter and his Hall of Fame almost unanimous ballot. Wednesday, before leaving Davos, Switzerland for his return to Washington, President Trump was asked by a reporter if he had considered attending the impeachment trial as a visitor. The president smiled, and then he replied that he would maybe do that, and he would certainly like to, but he was pretty sure his defense team would frown if he showed up. Well, Thursday, Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, reached out to the president and invited the president to be his guest in the visitor gallery at the Senate just to look in and watch them while they try to kick him out of office. I'd love to see him walk in there, wouldn't you? Representative Val Demings took the stand to discuss the U.S. obligation to provide Ukraine with aid to, quote, counter Russian aggression and shorten the war in the East. 15,000 people, she said, have been killed, 1.4 million displaced as a result of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. She says the U.S. has provided $1.5 billion in security assistance to Ukraine, and that's since 2014, another $1.5 billion in other types of assistance. What she did not mention was that the Obama administration routinely held foreign aid, as does every president, I might add, in negotiations for those countries' actions. Obama withheld aid to Pakistan, $800 million, Colombia, $450 million, the Philippines, $433 million, Egypt, $260 million, Honduras, $30 million, Mexico, $26 million. Of course, Obama's VP threatened to withhold another $1 billion of aid to Ukraine. House managers failed to mention any of these. Day three of the trial ended on a sad note. House managers have used just 16 of their agreed to 24 hours to present their impeachment case. Therefore, the floor is theirs again for Friday, another 8 hours. The president's legal team is currently scheduled to begin their defense on Saturday. However, there's some conversation about waiting through the weekend and starting on Monday. There are two schools of thought there. If they go on Saturday, obviously the television audience in the U.S. is not going to be what it normally would be during a weekday. But then the other side is if they go ahead on Saturday, all of the Sunday talk shows will obviously be talking about what happens when they do their presentation on Saturday. We'll keep you posted there. Now, in closing, I'm going to read a letter written regarding impeachment. It is incredible in content. It's incredible in its spirit and its call to action. It's a letter that you need to hear. Now, I'm not going to tell you who wrote the letter until after I complete its reading. Turn your sound up. Turn it up loud so you can hear every bit of this. And here it is. "Mr. President, this is a day of solemnity and awe. I rise humbled that we are participating in a process that was mapped out more than 200 years ago by the founding fathers, and that the words we say today will be looked upon by historians and future Congresses for guidance. That is quite a responsibility. Growing up, our country and its government seemed like a mighty oak, strong, rooted, permanent, and grand. It has shaken me that we stand at the brink of removing a president, not because of a popular groundswell to remove him, and not because of the magnitude of the wrongs he committed, but because conditions in America has made it possible for a small group of people who hate the president and hate his policies to very cleverly and very doggedly exploit the institutions of freedom that we hold dear and almost succeed in undoing him. Most troubling to me are the conditions that allowed this to happen and the small group who precipitated them. It's the small group of lawyers and zealots who decided that they would invest time and money to exploit a weakness that people knew the president had, find a case to air it publicly, and use it to bring him down. What is so profoundly disturbing is not that this small group of haters hatched this plan. It's that this group, or any group, equally dogmatic and cunning, can come so close to succeeding. If you had asked me a year ago if people like this with such obvious political motives could use our courts, play the media, and tantalize the legislative branch to achieve their ends of bringing down the president, I would have said, not a chance. That doesn't happen in America. But it's happening. And in the future, it could be a left-wing zealous organization or a right-wing group or some other group with strong, narrow beliefs. We've got to understand how we've reached the point where any small group could have so much power. The president is an extraordinary but flawed individual. But so are many other revered leaders, including other presidents. And when we knew about their flaws or suspected as much, we didn't make that cause a celebration. Not because we condoned whatever flaw they might possess, but because we realize none of us are superhuman. We're all flawed. Let him without sin cast the first stone is no more a cliche today than it was almost 2,000 years ago. This democracy would not exist if only the perfect among us were allowed to contribute. There are many of us in politics and many in the media who carry on and opine as if we and they are perfect. We're not. Maybe we're seeking an impossible duality. We demand, as we should, that our elected leaders be held to the highest standard. And then we shine the brightest light imaginable to expose those who don't measure up. But of course, no one can meet that standard, particularly under the blinding bright glare of 21st century light. There is a fundamental question our society must address. How do we keep our standards high, but at the same time accept, as the founding fathers did, that our leaders are just human? Related to this is a second underlying cause that has allowed this small group of zealots to almost undo this president. It seems we have lost the ability to forcefully advocate for our position without trying to criminalize or at least dishonor our adversaries, often over matters having nothing to do with the public trust. And it is hurting the country. It is marginalizing and polarizing the United States Congress. In today's environment, it would be easy, but wrong, to lay the blame for this predicament simply on a narrow band of zealots out to destroy this president. It would be easy, but wrong, to say that the only reason the president survived this scandal is a strong economy. What began long ago with Watergate as a solemn and necessary process to force a president to adhere to the rule of law has grown beyond our control so that now we are routinely using criminal accusations and scandal to win the political battles and ideological differences we cannot settle at the ballot box. Both parties are to blame. In conclusion, we've all been shaken by these last 6 months, but there are two glowing beacons of optimism, two strong oaks that still stand mightily. The first is the wisdom of the founding fathers. Every year I live and every year I serve, I am ever increasingly amazed at their wisdom and their genius. They didn't know there would be political parties, but a simple mathematical fraction, two-thirds, a two-thirds majority in the cooling saucer of the Senate, meant that removal of a president from office would have to involve more than the whims of a narrow band of politicians. We walked up to the abyss, and it was simply the elegant mathematics of the founding fathers that kept us from going over. They have pulled America back from the brink of future chaos that might occur if we remove this president. God bless the founding fathers. The second oak is the American people. They are not necessarily as informed as we are on the intricate particularities of this case. They didn't follow every twist and turn, but they know that any president's wrongdoing reflects human frailty rather than malevolence or any abuse of power or duty. They know from their common sense wisdom that this does not rise to the level of impeachment and removal, either as defined by the Constitution or as defined by their common sense of justice, fairness, and right and wrong. They know that if they were in the president's shoes, they aren't sure how they would react. Many of my colleagues excoriate any mention of the polls, but my colleagues on this side of the aisle have cited the polls not as politicians putting their fingers in the wind, but as a measure of what the American people feel. In the eyes of the founding fathers, That is a legitimate consideration in deciding whether a president should be removed. And for 6 months, the American people in every segment of the country have been unwavering in their view that the president should not be removed unless the people decide in the upcoming election. They remain unshakable in their belief that the Congress, the courts, and the press have gone too far. They are the only truly rational actor in the whole drama. God bless them. The people and the founders are the twin oaks that stand tall amidst this sad episode of American history. But if the cycle of political recrimination and scandalizing continues, the American people will become more alienated and cynical and shaken by the political process, and they too will lose faith in the great instrument the founding fathers have given us. If it gets to the point where the American people become too cynical, we could lose it all. After this is over, let's end the recriminations. Let's not blame each other. Let's instead think about what brought us to this point. Let us shake hands and say we are now going to forego bringing down people for political gain. Let us understand that our leaders have foibles, and though we must be held to a higher standard, let us not make it a sport to expose those weaknesses. The American people have saved us from ourselves. Let's not ask them to do it too many more times. That's an amazing letter. It's very amazing because it gets right to the heart of what's going on. The American people, we own the United States of America. And this gentleman got it right. He really got it right. He spoke to where we all either are in our thinking or we should be about this impeachment going on. Incidentally, the letter was written in 1999, and it was written by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer regarding the impeachment trial of President Bill Clinton. Some amazing similarities to that trial and this one, right? However, very different 180 degrees opposing attitudes. Day three in the books, day four underway. Today in Washington. That means that we'll be back tomorrow morning with our bullet points, and it'll be our Saturday normal bullet points. But we'll talk about what happened on Friday in the Senate chamber, and we'll also tell you what the schedule is going forward through the weekend, early next week, regarding the continuation of the Senate impeachment trial regarding should they remove the president from office or not by the U.S. Senate. That's all ahead. Make sure you stay close. We're here every day at Truth News Network, truthnewsnet.org. So long, everybody.
Real truth, real news. TNN, the Truth News Network.